Abandonment is a cumulative wound containing all the disconnections, disappointments, and heartbreaks of a lifetime. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shit show. I'm a recovering alcoholic. I am an adult child of an alcoholic family. What did I say in my very first episode? I said, I'm 5'11". Thank God I started smoking at 12 or I would have been 7'1". I enjoy Real Housewives. I think I said I also enjoyed 90 Day Fiancé. I don't really watch 90 Day Fiancé anymore. What else should you know about me? I love carbs, condiments, and cheese. I am a former CPA turned podcaster, and I am the captain of this hot mess of a ship. Hot mess. I am a hot mess. A hot mess of a ship that we have here. And I just like to give myself a little pat, pat, pat on the back because, folks, it is 6:30 on Monday night. I'm going to have my podcast done on Monday night. This is big strides, folks, okay? If you're new, I struggle with procrastination, as many of us, ye adult children, do. And in case you didn't know, procrastination is a form of perfectionism. It also is a way that we create negative excitement in our life. And so I have been journaling. I've been sharing my experience with procrastination as I've been going through this podcast and giving myself a pat on the back for it not being 6:30 on a Tuesday night, which it typically is. Making moves, folks, making moves. So today we are diving deep with Peter Yelton. Now, Peter Yelton is a therapist and I have been wanting to speak to him for quite some time. So I have mentioned him on the podcast a few times whenever I have had an abandonment trauma guru, Susan Anderson, on the podcast. So in her book, The Abandonment Trauma, what is it called? The Abandonment Recovery Workbook, she quotes Peter. And this quote shooketh me and shooketh me every time that I read it and say it out loud. So buckle up. Abandonment is a profound enough trauma to implant an invisible drain deep within the self that works insidiously to siphon off self-esteem from within. Now, when I read that for the first time, I about shit my pants. It was like when I read trait 12 of the laundry list. We are dependent personalities who are terrified of abandonment and will do anything to hold on to a relationship in order not to experience painful abandonment feelings, which we receive from living with sick people who are never there for us emotionally. Yes, 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 that is me. Now, this abandonment shit is really the heart of the matter for me. It is the heart of the matter for so many of us. It talks about in the Big Red Book. I should probably say, what is the Big Red Book in case you're wondering? So the Big Red Book is the primary text of the 12-step program, Adult Children of Alcoholic and Dysfunctional Families. But so in the Big Red Book, it talks about how this abandonment and shame, like those are the core wounds of an adult child. And when we think about it, you know, these laundry list traits are really rooted in this attempt to avoid being shamed and abandoned. You know, like our people pleasing, approval seeking, feeling guilty, saying no, codependency, and inability to speak up for ourselves. These are all attempts to avoid being shamed and abandoned. The real kicker is, though, folks, the real kicker is that unfortunately, these behaviors ultimately perpetuate more shame and more abandonment, particularly self-abandonment. So I think I remember asking Susan one time, like, does Peter ever do podcasts? And I can't remember what she said, but it was like 2 weeks ago. I looked down and I have a text and it's like, hey, this is Peter Yelton. I wanted to see about maybe coming on your podcast. And I think I had an audible cry out loud. So Peter, he's one of us. He has lived quite the life, so much wisdom, so much personal experience, so much professional experience. You are in for a real damn treat. He's a fascinating human. And we are talking about, you know, his abandonment, abandonment trauma, what the hell to do about it. So let's just get the damn show on the road because this is a goodie. And I've got some goodies coming up for you folks. I did a bunch of interviews last week and I got some more this week too. So you're in for some goodies coming up in the near future. But I'm going to put the links to, I've had Susan Anderson on the podcast twice. I will put links to those two episodes in the show notes. Those are also must listen episodes. And I'm actually going to be interviewing her again shortly in a few weeks. So we'll have her back on. So let's get on with it. But first, let's talk about why you need to damn the Join Shit Show. This is my online support community where I host 4 weekly Zoom support groups. There is also a group for, they meet on Wednesday nights for childhood sexual abuse survivors. There's a group on Friday nights or Friday afternoons that is for those who are going through divorce and separation. We have all these little diddle sub communities. We have chat, we have posts, we have fun, we laugh, we cry. This is a support system at your fingertips, in your back pocket. I want to give a shout out to the newest members of the Shit Show community. So thank you to these fine ass shit shows. Tina, Katie, Kimberly, Genevieve, Owen, Johan, Andrea, Mary Frances, Julia, another Andrea. Both of these people could be Andreas, but we know around here we're calling them Andrea. Carrie, Alex, Shelley, Ryan, Noel, Nicole, Gina, Chris, Laura, Sonia, Jessica, and Shelby. Thank you. How about the rest of y'all? Go follow suit. Damn the Join Shit Show. See the link in the show notes. You can just quit after a month, but you need to give it a try. Okay, just give it a try. You also should give my newsletter a try. Okay, so I have the Shit Show Nation newsletter that I'm gonna start sending out every week. I sent out an email yesterday about not feeling safe and asking for help and making progress. So you can also find a link to sign up for my newsletter in the show notes as well. Please give me a little follow on Insta, on the TikTok, at Adult Child Pod. And last but not least, whatever you do, please give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple and Spotify. It is required around here. Thank you. Love you all. All right, y'all. Well, I've wanted to interview this man for quite some time. I have mentioned his quote. Well, you have many quotes, but you have the one that I absolutely love. We have Peter Yelton, and he is the man who said the quote. Let me find it. Let me pull it up here. And I want to know if you remember when you said this for the first time. Here we go, folks. Abandonment is a profound enough trauma to implant an invisible drain deep within the self that works insidiously to siphon off self-esteem from within. Oof. Do you remember?
I remember the first time. I do. I remember I was having lunch on Susan Anderson as she was writing her first abandonment book. We would talk about it and we were brainstorming. We each had our abandonment stories. I had a profound abandonment story that I think of when I share it with you, it's going to see why it was so deeply implanted in me. You know, this is more my personal experience than my clinical experience. What it was is they say in a lot of recovery programs and other things, if you want good self-esteem, do esteemable things. Mm. That's not wrong. However, if the trauma is blocking it, all the esteemable things get washed away. That's the invisible drain. So, you know, I'm doing all this thing. I'm, you know, going to the gym. I'm taking, you know, I'm being kind to people. I'm doing this. I'm sponsoring people in programs. And I still feel like the bottom dropped out. And I feel like just a ball of useless tar. And it just comes over. Like, what happened? Or it might feel like I was feeling okay and the bottom dropped out. Maybe a little, some kind of disappointment. But the esteemable things that didn't get into the deeper levels, because they were blocked off by the trauma. Now, when we look at trauma theory, you could say it more eloquently, but that invisible drain is like, so we have to keep going, had to keep going deeper and deeper. And when I first learned, I always knew I was adopted. And the people that adopted me weren't really equipped to be parents.
Were you adopted as a baby?
I was adopted at 10 months, but with the abandonment was really started at the core. What I was later to find out is I was born in a movie theater stall in Manhattan, in the Times Square area.
What's a stall? Is that like a where you would go to like watch porn or something?
No, a stall, a bathroom stall.
Oh, okay.
In the woman's room. It's interesting because it later turned in, that venue turned into a porn place later on. But it was a movie theater. It was a Pix movie theater on 42nd Street, you know, as I did the research. And I was basically, a woman went in to go to the woman's room, saw blood, called an usher called a cop. A policeman came in and cut my umbilical cord and cleaned me up and hand carried me to a hospital.
Without your mother?
No, she was there. The only trace of my mother was in the police report. They said there was a dark-haired woman appearing about 19 years of age, attractive, who was acting suspiciously around the ticket booth. That was the only indication of my mother.
Jeez Louise.
So when abandonment, you know.
Well, then you think about everything that was going on while you were in the womb.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's all that fucking trauma.
Yep.
Wow. Do you remember how you felt like when you read that information? How long ago was that when you found that out?
Let's see. I was, it was interesting. It was right after my 50th birthday. So that was in, I'm 77 now. So I'm not good at math. So it was right after my 50th birthday. Essentially, I had a very loving birthday party celebration. And I got the information a couple of weeks later. It was almost like I had all the good stuff to do. What happened from a trauma point of view is I re-experienced the trauma because as I'm reading the report, they said I was full term, slightly cyatonic. So but half an hour in the incubator, I was fine, and full birth weight and so forth. But a few weeks later, I had a case of pneumonia, you know. And a month after I got this information, I had all these psychosomatic symptoms of pneumonia that would last for about half an hour. Luckily, I knew enough about trauma to know that I wasn't completely crazy. And my body remembered it. My body clearly remembered the pneumonia.
So prior to learning that information, did you only just know I was adopted at 10 months old? Is that all you had?
I was adopted. Yeah, the information was sketchy. My sister was also adopted. And
older or younger?
Younger. She's a couple years younger, 2.5 years younger. You know, from an agency where there's no biological connection. There was always some kind of saying, don't ever find out where you came from because somebody could get in trouble. I never paid much attention to it. And then when I was in high school, my sister was in high school, maybe I was a freshman in college, and it was some story my mother saw about two upper middle class people who got pregnant and they gave up the baby for adoption because college is more important. And she said to our mother said to my sister, oh, that's your story, like your story. Turned out not to be the case at all. And with mine, she says, well, you know, you were left in a basket at the police station. So I said, oh. And what I realized is I actually had done some guided imagery and things like that, the therapy thing. And the therapist said, what's the look on the woman's face as she's leaving? I said, it feels like a man leaving. I didn't know the information about the two first contacts with the usher and the policeman. I had no idea about that at that time.
That's so interesting. Like from the perspective of like your mom, like what would they, she's just like, I don't want it. Like, you know what I mean? It's just like, I'm just thinking.
She chose. Yeah. It was basically, in my opinion, she didn't want to know that anything existed before her. Mm-hmm. So therefore that was a threat.
No. Yeah. Like when the cops come to the movie theater.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm.
And then it's just like, they just take it and then she's just on her merry way. Like that part is so bizarre.
I don't think the police ever met her. I think when the police came to interview the scene, the clerk at the ticket booth described the woman.
She was not there. Holy shit. Wow. What, you know, so I've heard these stories before, which is like really hard to believe, but like where people are like, all of a sudden they're like, going through labor and they had no idea that they were pregnant. Like, have you heard that? Like, I don't know how that's possible.
I mean, my understanding of it, you know, because I wanted to learn more about it. My understanding is it happens more with evidently Caucasian young women. They're in denial that they're pregnant. So they're, you know, and I've seen it. I've worked with young women who were well into pregnancy, and they weren't kind of, they were detached from the fact that they were pregnant. So it was almost like this is a sense of denial. But I was full term. Wow. And a reasonably big baby, you know, so.
So do you remember learning that you were adopted, or this was just something that you just always knew?
No, the being adopted, my adoptive parents handled pretty well. There was basically a story of one time two people wanted to have a baby and they couldn't because there was something growing in mommy's tummy. So therefore there was no room for the baby. So she couldn't have any babies. And they went to this place and they adopted a baby. And then they wanted another baby. So we went back and I picked out my sister, you know, type thing. And that was our story. And I would basically sit on my dad's lap and we would tell the story together. And that was very warm.
You were aware that you, and your sister was also aware that she was adopted.
Yeah. And they actually celebrated it. We had an adoption day, which would be the anniversary of our adoption. It was like a birthday, but it was only for the four of us. You know, and you got to choose what you wanted to eat and you got a little present. So it was like a mini birthday. But it was very clear it was just for us, because I remember being about six probably. And my grandmother was there. My mother's mother was there. So, oh, Grandma, you can't be here, you know, because it was just to distinguish it from a birthday.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And so was there any shame there consciously for you as a kid?
No, it was a little different, you know, but it not really. I mean, I had tons of shame, but, you know, my father turned out to be an alcoholic and a small temperament, middle-class banker to a really obvious alcoholic. So there was tons of shame. I don't think the adoption one was the shame one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So before we get into that, I just want to circle back to the siphon off the wound, siphon off the self-esteem. So the way that hit home so much for me was that I would get into a relationship and it would be a toxic relationship. I get out of it. I was not one that would hop from one to the next. I would have like significant period of time in between. I would feel so good about myself. I would be convinced that I was going to do things differently in the next relationship. And then as soon as I got into the next one, immediately my peace of mind, my serenity became hijacked. And I had no fucking clue that what I was experiencing was trauma. No clue. It was baffling.
Exactly the same pattern for me. I would go along and all of a sudden I'd be in a relationship. I was euphoric.
As soon as that abandonment gets triggered, just a little bit.
Once the abandonment gets triggered, I've lost complete sense of myself.
Mm-hmm.
So the functioning adult becomes a helpless child. And what I realized actually became, in some ways, the relationships go more, that they were more problematic because the trauma went to a deeper place. To in a relationship, about 10, 11 years ago, it was almost that wounded child who chose the person.
Mm-hmm.
He had no idea what he was getting in for. And I don't know what his dynamics were on his side, but so it'd be a way of saying when it was very good, it was very good. And when it was very bad, it was very bad. But the fear, once I found that connection, the terror of losing that connection totally upended my life.
Me too, man.
Just the exact
same ways that drugs and alcohol did.
Yep. Yes.
Even worse.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand. People were like, go to work, take your mind off of it. Like I couldn't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious for you. So like you were active in AA at the time, correct?
Right. Well, I guess these things were going on. I didn't realize that in my second year of recovery, you know, it was in between my fourth and fifth step. I was looking at everything. That's when the abandonment wound came open.
Mm-hmm.
And there was somebody I was dating, somebody I met, and I just, it was like I became obsessed with him. And when that blew up in smoke, the abandonment wound came in. Mm-hmm. And I have never experienced pain like that in my life. Mm-hmm. Here I am in my early 40s, 42, 43 years old, and I was unable to function. Interestingly enough, my sponsor in AA, who really, I believe we were magically spiritually connected. She was raped and incested as a 14-year-old, had a male baby that she put up for adoption. Wow. So psychologically and spiritually, we became our missing pieces. And we were able to work together for over 20 years. And it was the ultimate corrective emotional experience for me. But she knew.
She knew what was going on with
intuitively,
you.
Yeah. And so we walked through that, but it was devastating.
I didn't have anybody that knew what was going on, you know? And I felt so much shame about it because I can't remember if I shared this with you on the phone. It was like, you know, my other friends that I got sober with, like, yeah, they weren't picking the best people, like in early sobriety, right. But then they slowly their picker got better, you know, and mine wasn't. And the amount of shame that I like, it just kept happening. I was such an emotional vampire every time I was in these situations and I couldn't figure out what the fuck was going on with me. And it wasn't until 7 years sober is when I figured it out. And I was at a meeting and I heard a woman talk about hitting a bottom at 7 years sober. And she realized how much her childhood had impacted her. And she mentioned the book, Adult Children of Alcoholic and Dysfunctional Families. And I go home and I read it. My mind's blown. And then I go back the next week and I'm like, thank you so much for what you shared. And she goes, I just want to let you know that just reading that book's like not going to be enough. She goes, this is going to take you years and years and years. And you're going to have to treat this as seriously as your sobriety. And I'm like 28 at the time. And I'm thinking, years, lady? I don't got years. You know, I don't got years, lady. I got a couple months, maybe. You know, I got a couple months. I got to figure this shit out. And I really just hope that her childhood was like way more fucked up than mine. And I was just like, okay, I'll take a year off of dating. I've read this book. I'm good. Nope. 9 years. Most painful experience of my entire life. And it was through that experience that I realized just how powerful this experience is. So whenever I am in meetings, in AA meetings, and it's appropriate, I bring this up because I think that there are a lot of people sitting in the rooms that have no idea. This is why they're still in so much fucking pain.
Absolutely agree. And because the picker, you know, because the bad picker, what I didn't realize was the person picking was the traumatized part. The part of me, the, you know, in internal family systems theory, the exile is the traumatized, the exile. So the exile is doing the picking. And until I could get in the room with the exile, you know, because the choices that were healthy for me were just so unattractive. They were boring.
Yes.
You know?
See you later.
You know, and one of the clinical things here, which I think is really important in our understanding of abandonment, is some of our picking and things like that say, my God, you've got a borderline personality disorder or something like that. So it could be pathologized into a personality disorder, which is not what we have. We have a bad picker. I love that from your literature. I hadn't heard it in a while, but boy, it just says it, you know. And so that the bad picker is basically our attempt to heal. The bad picker is bringing to light, because you can function in all the other areas. I function professionally, friends and things like that, even in a pretty family, you know, riddled with alcoholism and codependency, I can't even function there. But when it came to the primary romantic relationship, that's when the bad picker came out. And so I had to make the bad picks to go on the journey of healing.
The only way. Do you have memories of being a child and experiencing the same feelings that you felt in an emotional flashback?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. The terror of being abandoned. I mean, this was reported to me by my mother. Now, she, my adoptive mother, not the best reporter of what was going on. I mean, she almost should have got a PhD in revisionist history. But the thing is, or the Duchess of Denial, as we kind of called her, but she said when I was a year to 18 months, she never left me, but once in a while she'd go to doctor's appointment. She left me with my maternal grandmother, who was somewhat warm, you know, and I would be in a total meltdown the whole time. So that there was this raging terror of abandonment. I remember feeling it, being petrified of it, terrified. It just ran the show.
For me, it showed up. Like I had to sleep in my mom's bed at night. I couldn't go to sleepovers. And that was how I connected the dots, was when I realized that the way that I was feeling when somebody I dated for less than a month broke up with me, I said, holy shit, this is how I felt as a 9-year-old girl, where I felt like I was going to die if I didn't sleep in my mom's bed.
And the you know, as I work with people that have experiences, you know, I'm working with a young woman now who experienced it, and it was due to the untimely death of her mother when she was about 8 years old, but it was coming out in every place else, you know, and it took her a while to connect the dots. Why am I not getting over this boyfriend? I've been struggling with the feelings of getting over him way longer than we were together. I said, you're right where you're supposed to be. And so it took her a while to pull up it was reenacting the trauma of losing her mom. And so she lost her mom at 7. So when these losses come in earlier, wow.
Yeah. So I hear that, like, you hear so much about like 0 to 2 years old, but do you think that somebody could have a somewhat normal, like 0 to 6, and then have something happen to them that really fucks them up?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. I think the earlier it is, it's the harder it is to get at it.
Yeah.
That's the idea of complex trauma. It's one builds on the other. It's almost like the dent is there, and then the rewounding comes into that spot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Let's circle back to your upbringing. So talk just about what it was like with your father's alcoholism and what your experience was, and when did you start drinking? And
yeah, well, the real, because there's a whole abandonment piece there. They adopted us. And so I was his, you know, he just fell in love with me. He was just, all the pictures were him and me. And so, and it was just, I don't remember too much. And then when I was three and a half, my sister got adopted, things like that. And I remember that. I do remember going in and picking her up and going and those things like that. There's all these pictures of him and me. My mother would be taking the pictures. She'd be in some of them. But when, just before I was going to start kindergarten, so I was 4, almost 5, his mother came to live with us. And he flipped out. He was like Jekyll and Hyde. And evidently, he flipped out. And
did he not have anywhere to go?
No, he was, you know, she was like an invalid and stuff like that. And doctor said, well, just let her stay in Brooklyn and, you know, put her in the hospital. She'll die, you know. And you know, but they brought her in and she stayed in our house. Totally disrupted. But whatever the trauma he had with her, I'll never know. And so basically he was never sober again. He went from being, so at 5, by 7 or 8, he wasn't working anymore. By 9, he wasn't working anymore, and he was institutionalized. It became worse and worse. He was involuntarily committed to a state hospital by the time I was 12, and he escaped, and it was pretty hard, some really horrible scenes. Finally, when I was a freshman in college, or sophomore in college, he escaped, and he got to California.
Wow.
He got to California. So he wasn't a criminal, and that wouldn't – because the commitment to a psychiatric facility is a state commitment, he wasn't a fugitive.
Wow. So that was so 12 is when he officially left home?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what?
Well, 10, no. 12, no, it was 10. 10, he, sixth grade.
Wow. Yeah. And so what was the impact of that to your mom? Like, what was her role in all of it?
She just, she went back and got a master's degree and became a teacher to support the family. And, you know, she really pushed hard to, you know, cover all the bases and things like that.
Uh-huh. And did, well, I guess first was what was going on explained to you? Like, was it talked about, or were you just picking up on things?
It was weird because it was explained to me, but not in an emotional way.
Yeah, me too.
So he came home and he was screaming. This is before the hospitalizations. he was still commuting to the city, and he came home and he's screaming. I guess the guy's commuting, played cards on the train. And he's screaming at me for cheating in cards. Mm. There were no cards around. I was, let's say, six at this point. And my mother says, oh, yeah, he's got you confused with the guys on the train. It's like, makes no sense. You know, so it was explained in an intellectual way, you know, but that, you know, she was very emotionally, she was smart, but she was emotionally limited. So there was like abandonment from her too. I remember one story, I had alopecia at 12. Talk about the trauma, that my whole body reacted. And, you know, they told me he's a troubled child, you know. But in the alopecia, I was petrified. I'm in a dermatologist's office. I'm 10 years old. I look freakish, you know. Mm-hmm. And then the dermatologist is saying, and it wasn't a great bedside matter guy. And he just said, finally, he said, well, this is a case of alopecia areata. And my mother burst into this, like a little girl grin. And I was petrified. And she wanted to impress him that she knew that meant falling hair in Latin, because she knew Latin. And I could have been on another planet. I felt so abandoned, like I didn't even, because I thought they were going to tell me I was going to die. And she just checked out.
When he went away, like, would you go visit him?
Yeah. Talk about denial. Would go out to the state hospital, and he would rage about all these degenerate people. I didn't know what that meant. And, you know, stuff like that. They're allowed to walk around the grounds, and he was locked up. So she would go in and talk to the doctor. We were locked in the car for 45 minutes with all these strange people around. And then we'd go to the beach and sit on the blankets with the other families from our town, like nothing was else going on. It was like, I think back of it now, and I went, so these are all abandonments.
No shit. One flew over the cuckoo's nest. Were you the scapegoat?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was like there were two of us. So I was the hero and the scapegoat. My sister was the mascot and the lost child.
And so how did you fare, like, in school? And were you getting into trouble? Were you teased? Did you have friends? What was your experience?
I have some pretty significant learning disabilities. They didn't know what it was. So he's not trying. He's not working up a potential, you know, severe writing disability. So school was hard. Socially, school was okay. I got along okay in school. I didn't like it, you know, but one year was, yet school was also incredibly wonderful. You know,
it was an escape.
In kindergarten, the teacher told my mother that she thought I was retarded. I heard that many, many years later, because I was just frozen. And it wasn't separating from, you know, I didn't mind leaving that house and going to school, but I was just petrified. My first grade teacher, I'll never forget it, she taught me how to write. She says, you can do this. And she was teaching. I held the pencil. So I was so traumatized. I held the pencil so tight I was breaking it. And she says, you can do this. And I remember her. I remember going back years later and substituting in that school, and I remembered her. It was this warm feeling, you know. Mrs. Hayes was her name.
And, that was my first grade teacher's name was Mrs. Hayes. Yeah, that's right. Crazy.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So she was. Oh, that's wild. So she's great. And then school was, you know, fifth grade was horrible because I had a teacher that was really very mean, and that was the year my father's, you know, alcoholism got the worst, and he crashed the car in a small town. It was in the paper. And I remember the rage I felt. You know, I felt this. I remember one time, normally if I had trouble in school, my mother would go up. But he had lost his job in the bank, and he was sort of put himself together in job interviewing. Mm. So he presented well in a suit and stuff like that. And he went in, and she was telling him how bad I was. And we were in the car. It was the old car. We had a bench seat. And he got in the car, and I saw the bottle on the seat, and I knew hell was going to come that night. And just the idea of being caught between their two rages. I've gone back to that, you know, place and done some interesting psychodramas, and basically actually stood on that corner where the car was. And I just basically said, you know, I just said, I'm going to take the kid. You are out of here. You just lost the right to be a father. And so to, you know, sort of comfort that child was abandoned by, you know.
Okay. So then you said that he got out when you were 19. He went to California.
Yeah.
And did you see him after that at all?
No, I never did. I was writing. It was interesting. I was writing letters to him, stuff like that. And this time he was pretty wet brained by now, you know, alcoholic dementia.
How was he living? Like just stealing, panhandling?
I guess he was getting, he got Social Security disability.
Okay.
He was in a single room occupancy. His brother was there. They had some interaction.
Okay.
As far as we know. But what was interesting, the end of it, of the story was, it was 1967. I was working at Jones Beach. My sister graduated from high school the day before. And my mom was teaching summer school. So the phone rang and they said, "This is the coroner from Ventura County, California. We want to, you're listed as next of kin. We regret to tell you your father passed away." I went, "Oh, so I don't think I'm the next of kin. I think his brother was there." The guy, the coroner hesitated. He says, "We buried your uncle 3 weeks ago." I went to find my sister, and in the doorway was this box addressed to me in his handwriting. He had impeccable handwriting. And in the box was the folded flag, because his brother had been in the military, a picture of his brother, and the funeral card. And it was so, I just felt like, oh my God, because, you know, I am him, you know, and that made an incredible impression on me.
Do you know how his brother died?
Probably, the brother was probably about 62. My father was 57. Alcoholism as well, I assume.
Mm-hmm. And did your mother struggle with substances at all?
Yeah. She, I always said they took turns. She, I guess maybe during my college years, a little bit after, you know, she was, her parents had lived with us, and then they died of old age. So I guess nobody was watching. She was like emotionally like a little girl. So she started drinking, and she was definitely alcoholic.
Mm-hmm. So then talk about how things unfolded for you, like in adulthood. Like, when did your drinking really pick up?
Yeah, it's funny. I was a late starter, unlike you, which is kind of the opposite of the spectrum. I kind of knew this wasn't going to work out well, unconsciously. You know? So I didn't drink much until college. And then, but when I did, I drank too much, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, but alcohol helped me function.
Mm-hmm.
You know, through college, young adulthood, I could navigate it. It sort of completely clouded the waters of being, I was in denial about being gay, and I just wanted that to go away. And, you know, the alcohol just blurred that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it went along, and then all of a sudden, it started to speed up. And, you know, it's almost like I got off the local and went on the express train. And then in the summer of 88, I knew something was wrong. I mean, I would catch myself. I was in charge of substance abuse programs for a school district. And I still think of that. I roll my eyes at myself, you know. And I've told that story I don't know how many times, you know. I got drunker than any of the kids at the senior prom. And, you know, so and passed it off, you know. But the end came in a profound dream with my father in it. You know, I knew I was out of control. I basically had called in sick the next day, which I hardly ever did. Probably some days I shouldn't have shown up there. But I went in and I just had this profound dream that I saw him. And, you know, I was talking with him. And a colleague had shared with me, he was in AA, another therapist. And I said, I called him. I said, "Bob, I got to come talk with you." And I did. But that dream was my bottom.
Wow.
You know, they say spiritual awakening. I had to have it while I was asleep because I was so stubborn. They had to come and get me while I was asleep. And then I've never had a drink since.
Wow.
I mean, I went to AA right away, and 36 years, I'm still there.
What was your experience in getting sober initially? Like, was there a pink?
I just, it was like, I said, okay, this is like a new adventure. I remember I had a good friend, we sort of came out together. We're good friends. I always said his backyard is my rehab. I'd be busy working two jobs during the week. Then weekends, I'd go there, go to a meeting in the morning, go to a meeting at night. And it was like, okay. So for a year and a half, it was wonderful. You know, then I felt things I never felt before. And then a year and a half into it, I had the romantic meltdown that brought me into the abandonment thing we just talked about.
Like, what was the career path? Were you already like a therapist at this point?
Yeah,
like, what?
I was already a
and
therapist.
And why did you decide you wanted to do that?
I was working. I was a teacher. I got out of college. I had this wonderful job at Jones Beach. I just loved working there. So I said, okay, I got out of college in January. I said, well, okay, I thought I'll substitute teach. And I started substitute teaching in a really Wyandanch. It was in 68, it was the year Martin Luther King was shot. It was a wild school district, but there was something about
where was this?
In Wyandanch on Long Island, you know, real, yeah. And so I did that, and I said, wow, this is, I like this. I really like the kids. And then I taught at a parochial school the next year to get a teacher's license. And then I taught in Deer Park. I love teaching, but I love the problem kids more. Then I was working at a youth center. So I went to social work school to become a soldier and then worked at a clinic, a drug and alcohol clinic while I was still active. And then I went to the school district, it's where I met Susan, and I went to the school district and I was there 12 years before I got sober. And
were you like a social worker? Counselor?
Yes. School social worker, you know.
And did she do the same thing?
Yeah, she was in the elementary school. I was in the high school. And so we actually knew some of the same families. But it was a wonderful career. I still think about it. And I still, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. But had I not got sober when I did, I would have lost that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So did you say before that part of what stirred things up to you was doing your fourth and fifth step? Is that what you were saying?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Somehow in going through the fourth and fifth step, it was like, okay, all the things that I had, all the traumas that I had kept at bay with the help of alcohol. Well, okay, we got rid of the alcohol. Now we're going to go in there and start digging. Mm-hmm. And that failed relationship. So I was right between the four. I'd done the fourth step, hadn't done the fifth when I met this guy.
Okay. And was he also when did you come out of the closet?
Yes. What? Pardon me?
When did you come out?
It was gradually. I came out, but then when I got sober, I had to come out all over again, because I had to do it. I just changed different bars I was hanging out in, So the coming out was really, and that was right. See, what really got, one of the things that really got me to get sober, and I'll be eternally grateful for it, is I was always trying to do things on the outside to cover from the emptiness on the inside. So, and I, have an incredibly powerful track record working with troubled kids. It's a gift that I have and I love. So I was always good at that and I loved doing it. But I said, no, I got to do more. So I was working, it was the first AIDS group on Long Island, one of the first groups. And it was gay and bisexual men and IV drug users. But some of the gay and bisexual men were in recovery. So, and the IV drug users were in recovery. So they were in the group. It was in those days where everybody was fighting. You faggots gave it to us. You junkies gave it to us. And basically, they knew better than that. I just opened the door. Mm-hmm. They ran the group. Mm-hmm. But I watched them doing everything they could to stay alive. This is long before the protease drugs. From diagnosis to death was 13 weeks.
Yeah.
Somehow, I couldn't reconcile their fighting for life as I was. That really is what brought me to say, something's wrong. Mm.
Yeah. Living in San Francisco, it's interesting hearing people that were in long-term sobriety and just hearing them talk about how everyone was dying. And also what I think is interesting is that it seems like that's what really brought the lesbian and the gay community together. Was that they were kind of at odds before that. And then through that crisis, lesbians were taking care of the gays and you guys kind of united that way.
Right. So it was the worst. It was the best of times and worst of times. It was the time I got sober. And then so many people got diagnosed with HIV and got sober. So there was this incredible energy of people working together. And it's a powerful, the groups, recovery groups and some other self-help groups. My home group, it was an Al-Anon group in New York. There were 150, 200 members of that group. Over half of them have died of AIDS. Wow. You go into St. Vincent's Hospital. I just did an interview with the Project for Princeton University about this, sort of the oral history of what it was like. And we walked through the neighborhood with one of the PhD students, and he was recording it. So we go into St. Vincent's to see one person, and you'd see five others from your group.
Hmm. Another connection. I was born at a St. Vincent's Hospital, but it was in Birmingham, Alabama. So there we go.
This is Hayes in St. Vincent's Hospital.
So I want to hear about this relationship. Do tell. Were they in the program?
Yes, he was. Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, right. It's like, somebody described it as like you go to, they call it roundups. It was gay sober events. It was great. Okay. So, and they still go on.
They still do them, yeah.
Yeah, and something like that. So, in the AA book, it said boy meets girl on AA campus. And I changed it to boy meets boy on the AA campus.
Were you still in your first year?
No, I was in my second year.
Okay.
Because if I was, my sponsor was, you know, no, you stay on the first three steps of the first year. And then so, yeah, he was in the program.
You know what the expression I like is that the odds are good, but the goods are odd.
Right.
People in the program.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Or somebody, you know, a little dark said, don't fish in a polluted pool. But that's a terrible thing. I don't like that. Because there's some great people have met great relationships in the program. But it was like, it was an obsession. We spent a magic. We met. At
the thing, was this the first time that you were in a relationship with a man, like a real one?
No.
Or no?
Okay. No, I've been my last year drinking. I had been in a very healthy relationship with a man but I wasn't ready. And then later on, next relationship, it was my last year drinking. It was just two people grabbed each other, holding on for dear life. Mm-hmm. You know, he wasn't a drinker, but, you know, he was, you know, and so, it was right after we ended that I got sober, but not because of that, you know, but I never felt with the guy I met in at the thing. It was just like, I just became attached and I obsessed. Mm-hmm. We only spent a long weekend together.
Mm.
That was it.
That's all it takes, baby.
As one of my colleagues say, it's already too late. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was that. It was so it became my obsession. I mean, I did see him a few times afterwards, but we were, you know, but it was too volatile.
Woo! And so when did you lose your shit? For that weekend?
So, no, we were together for a month. We were together. It was the end of April. Right after that weekend. Mm-hmm. When I realized it didn't work, you know, and I think he was in another relationship. So I was just that. I just lost it. That month of May in 89 or 90, the month of May in 90, I was on.
What did it look like for you?
Absolute agony. It was like, I couldn't get out of it. You know, I didn't sleep well. I was just in agony. I was in just raw pain. Obsessive thinking, but just my emotions were just, you know, I just felt like I wanted to die. Mm-hmm. I actually said to myself, I lived down by the water on Long Island. I said, you know, if I go down to the end of the street and blow my brains out, I'd never gone. I'd do anything like that. I just said the pain would stop. Mm-hmm. That feeling of, you know, the pain is so intense. If we could just stop.
Yeah. We'll never get over it. This is the last person on earth that I'll ever be interested in. This is the last person on earth who will ever be interested in me.
Right. And if I have that person, I'm okay. And if I don't, I'm not. Nothing in between.
Ugh. No. So how long do you think it took you to get over that?
2-3 years. Over it. Maybe I'm not completely over it because I'm feeling as I'm talking to you right now. Not like it was, but there's still stuff there.
Yeah. Ooh. So, I mean, you talk about having this sponsor and having it be such a reparative experience, but what was your process in like realizing that it was trauma? And like, when did you learn about like complex PTSD and how did you like really get into this abandonment trauma work?
From Susan. Susan and I, you know, I had some trauma, you know, I did some trauma stuff, but in our work in exploring through Susan, we would kind of share our ideas, and then she introduced more theory into it. She's brilliant that way, incredibly brilliant. We would say, well, that's like so and so, and then I brought in some stuff from Bradshaw. So we kept bringing in resources, mostly her bringing outside resources, so that it came into, you know, and then gradually. When I took the IFS training, which is pretty intense training.
When was that?
About 15 years ago. That put names onto a lot of the things Susan and I were talking about. The exile and, you know, that type of thing and the managers. So that put that they put a nice, it was a very helpful language to formulate what we were doing, you know.
And so, but what did your, what did your healing journey look like? So you had that with the sponsor, but then... Mm-hmm. Did you get into like therapy? Like what I'm assuming that are you still in and out of relationships, shitty relationships?
Oh, no. I mean, there was enough healing that took place. So after another mini meltdown, something like that, where I really feel the exile chose the person. And I mean, that, you know, after a year and a half of processing that, I think I got to the bottom of it enough. So about 8 years ago, I met somebody and we dated very slowly. And part of me was pushing away because I was programmed to push away somebody who was good for me. Mm-hmm. And gradually I didn't push him away. And we grew together gently. And so we've been together 7.5 years. We were married in September, but it's clearly the right relationship for me at the right time. I know had we met earlier, it wouldn't have worked. And it's completely different than everything else. And for the first time in my life, the abandonment in a relationship, the abandonment stuff is barely there. And I was describing it to somebody recently. About 15 years ago, I was in a relationship. He was kind of a depressed type guy, my mother, So we were together and we didn't live together, but we spent like about 4 days a week together. We're up in Cape Cod in Provincetown where we lived. And I would go out in the morning to go to the gym or go to a meeting. And the way you go up the driveway, you'd have to be halfway up to the driveway to see the top of the driveway. And I realized after 18 months, I wasn't having a panic attack and his car was gone. Mm. This guy could be absent in the room with you, but he wasn't getting up in the morning and getting in the car and driving. There was nothing in his behavior that it was all my projection. It was 18 months before I didn't have physical panic in my body.
And in that relationship, were you open with them about what you were experiencing?
Yeah, I did to an extent. I just said in the beginning, if we're going to see each other, you've got to call when you say you're going to call. I said, this is about me. This is about my history. I said, we have to be clear. It doesn't have to be every day, something like that. But when we're expected to talk, you need to be there. Otherwise, I can't be in the relationship with you.
And did it ever happen?
No, we were fine. We were really, he heard that and we did it. Later on, the next one, I didn't set those boundaries and I paid the price. But I needed to go through that to get here.
Absolutely. So what for you personally, you talked a lot about psychodrama.
Right.
Can you talk about what has been most helpful modalities or, what has been in your healing journey, what has really been the most helpful for you?
Whatever type of therapy or self-help program that brings the feelings where the trauma can be verbalized, where the trauma can come out on the table, we can talk about it. So the IFS stuff was very helpful. But in the loving relationships in my life, my friends, I looked at the wedding and it was just filled with 100 people. I looked around the room, Susan was there. So, and it's funny, interesting. Some of my closest, newest friends who know more about my present trauma and Susan met. And I said, I don't know if I should have you all together. But it was so powerful. So sharing the journey deeply with people along the way and keeping consistent relationships with them, whether that's through the 12-step, where a lot of it's come from, or the IFS training, or that arena.
Can you talk about some of the parts that you identified?
Yeah, the abandoned child, the baby, that baby who's petrified, is that part is what's being healed now. I realize with my husband, that piece, that scared child, goes to sleep. It was funny because, I think we're most vulnerable before we put our head down and go to sleep. One day I was like, I'd slept well the night before. I had some client emergency on the phone and I just had a cup of coffee. He says, why don't you take a nap? I said, a nap? I'll never take a nap right now. 23 seconds later, I was asleep. So we kid about that. So that sense of that I can lay down and I'm not going to be abandoned. My body knows it. It's not even intellectual at this point. And what it is somehow the work, enough of this trauma has been deconstructed to know that even if he reminds me of my mother or something like that, he loves me in a way that my mother couldn't. So, but back to the invisible drain, somehow though that message got all the way into the beginning. I guess your question is how, all of the above.
Yeah. It takes a long fucking time.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I said. I said, you know, I'm really big into physical fitness now, and which is, there was so much shit because I was a kind of a klutzy kid, and my father wanted to be the super athlete, and he shamed me. So, and that you put the, you know, the gay piece on top of it, it was a disaster. So the idea that I've become a competitive athlete is, I'm just thrilled with. And not that I'm competing that much, competing more with myself.
What are you doing?
I said, I'm doing strength training, biking, rollerblading. And so what I'm so excited about is, I said, wait a minute. I don't, you know, it's great to get this trauma done, to get this insight and stuff like that. I want to take it on the road. I don't want to, you know. So, you know, and I'm looking at the Peter Attia work about longevity. I really believe, and again, I have no genetic history, you know, it's not there. We've done all the searching. And,
yeah, I was going to ask about that.
It was found what appears to be my birth mother, you know, ancestry came up with the two first cousins that are sisters. And we pretty well have it scoped out that we think we found an obituary and, you know.
Have you connected to them, to the first cousins?
The cousins, you know, the cousins just wanted to figure out who I was. They really didn't want to know. Okay. Oh, that aunt, it was her. You must be from her. They were very nice, but.
You're like, I'm the baby that was born in the toilet.
Yeah, no, they didn't care. They were nice. And it was nice to have that. It wasn't big. And one thing is funny, knowing my ethnicity, it was so good. I said, ooh. And I was kind of sensitive. It was Irish and Italian. But what was interesting was I said, I'm not of my adoptive family. I know I never belonged there. When I got in, now I know I don't have their genes. So that's good. But it's just kind of a icing on the cake.
Mm-hmm.
But no, so yeah, so there was, and then there's no hint of who
your dad is.
My biological father was. And mm-hmm. and I'm still, that's an educated guess with the mother. We don't know.
Yeah.
Because it was four sisters, it was the estranged sister geographically and time-wise would have made it possible. But there was a male child and he could have impregnated a woman that they don't even know, never knew existed. So that's the other possibility because we're first cousins.
Interesting. So what happened with your sister?
We're not close. She found out her adoption and with a couple, she had identifying information, got in touch with her birth mother. They had a nice, again, the story was not what my mother told. But they had a nice connection before she died. I felt great about that because I don't know if genetic stuff is more pronounced with women. I sense that it is, especially in the reproductive areas. So that the birth mother had ovarian cancer later on in life. So my sister knows that, her daughter knows it, her granddaughter knows it. So I think they had some nice closure with that.
Uh-huh. And then what about, how did things pan out with your mother?
We did pretty well. You know, this is really just for inner child stuff. It's very interesting. I was working really hard in Al-Anon, working with my sponsor. I could do love you before I hung up. Mm-hmm. And one day it was 95 and I would call her once a week and it had definitely gotten better. And she said, it was a Friday night. She said, I was going to a meeting. She called me. And we were going to two of my friends I grew up with. It's like family. And so she said, can you pick me up to go to the graduation party? I said, well, Mom, I'm going to be late because I had sabbatical from school this year, but I'm going to go to the kids' graduation. She said, well, I can make it. And she was about to be 80. So we're just talking. And she said, well, my 80th party. And she just did her. I said, well, I'm not getting along great with my sister, Jane. And she said, well, you know, she doesn't understand you. At this point, the conversation would usually devolve into, yeah, I do feelings, you people don't. And I just kept my mouth shut. Mm-hmm. And so she says, you know, your sister doesn't understand you. I said, yeah. She says, I understand you. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you told me about your life. These aren't her words. And I went, and she said, you know, she says, you've always been my boy. And I said, from my heart, I love you, Mom. And I was crying. And she said, no, I upset you. I said, no, Mom, their feelings, they're okay. It was sweet. That was a Friday night. Sunday, I at the graduation party, and she's not there. And I think I intuitively said something. And so my friend Mike came along and said, oh, there's your mother. And it was a big crowd. Then he came up to me and said, is your mother, you know, okay? I said, well, she probably wouldn't arrive drunk. She'd go home drunk. But I said, you know, he says, she just graduated me on going to college and it was his son. I went, you know, and then that Tuesday, she passed away. What it was is she had an aneurysm that was leaking. We put it together after the fact, but we had that closure. But however, 20 years later, as I'm doing some, we got really involved in the ACA program, I said, oh yeah, I had nice closure with her mother. Now I'm digging up the grave, to yell at her. I mean, that's what, this is the rage that came up, you know. So we had nice closure there. 20 years later, we had to go, and and the anger, and I'm much, finally, just in the last 6, 8, 9 months, it's, I've had a bunch of dreams that I've let go of some, a lot of the anger, you know. I can say, because I can't stand when people in programs say, well, they did the best they could.
And it wasn't good enough.
Yeah, but I did the best I could in geometry and went to summer school 3 times. So, no, you did. And the other piece that I've talked about in people whitewashing their parental stuff, I said, what was going on in my family rose to the level of calling child abuse according to the laws in 1955. So I said, protective services should have been called to my house. They should have been given a remediation plan, and if they didn't follow it, there could have been removal. Look, most kids aren't removed. A lot worse goes on where kids aren't removed. But to just validate that that did go on, I would say that. I would call protective services. So I said that in a meeting any number of times, so I would believe it.
Yeah.
Emotionally believe it.
Yeah, I think that this is also brings up an interesting point, though, of, you know, a lot of people think that it wasn't that bad, or like people think I shouldn't be this fucked up because it wasn't that bad. I mean, I was never physically or sexually abused. I was never told I was a piece of shit. And I'm curious what your perspective on it. For me, like what I like to say is that it's not so much about what exactly happened, but more about what you came to believe about yourself and the world as a result of what happened to you.
Right. Yes. Absolutely. So what I incorporated from the beginning is you are such a toxic piece of shit that we have to drop you and get out of here. You are so utterly toxic. I carried that. Talk about toxic shame. Doesn't begin. That's what I carried. That was my self-esteem. That was my
belief. Conscious for you? So for me, that was the part that was confusing for me, was because consciously, I thought I was pretty okay. My actions showed otherwise.
Some of both. Yeah, I certainly had my defenses against it. I knew.
Oh, I wanted to ask you. So you said that you didn't start drinking until like college. What were your coping mechanisms in childhood?
So, you know, I would be the acting out, but the bad kid, the sort of oppositional type kid at home and stuff like that, you know, and then also being overly codependent and helpful to people and things like that. It was Jekyll and Hyde, you know. Yeah. I was one of these things. I've done a lot of work with studying. I hate the word invulnerable kids, but resilient, you know, resiliency, you know, and now it's become very in fashion, but the whole resiliency, I think my resiliency was, I knew this was a shit show. If I was going to get anything positive, I had to go out in the world. And then what came from that later on is I was reading the adoption papers. I mean, the hospital records from the New York Family Hospital. Oh, you were the nurse's favorite. I said, I learned a goo-goo and gaga to get picked up from the beginning. Talk about instilling and installing codependency.
I'm curious about what your perspective was on alcoholism when you first got sober compared to now. Like, have your views changed?
Yeah, I realize now it's much more complicated, more complex. I mean, I still believe in AA. I go to AA. Probably just broke the world rules because I'm on the media. Whatever. And I know. I just thought of that, you know, talking about super ego. The thing is,
the way I say it is, I can't say that you're an AA, but I can say that I am.
Yeah, right. Okay, that's like. So let them come get me. So the thing is, I just had a picture of an army of big book thumpers running down the street. But so the thing is, alcoholism is much more complex than, you know, but the AA is a great method for me to get sober, for a lot of other people. And, you know, take what we want and leave the rest, I think is fine. It's a lot more complicated. And I have no problem there's a medical disease of alcoholism that's studied and treated. There's AA, which both, I don't see the conflict.
I think that, you know, I know for me, I had to get sober, and I'm sure you see it all the time. I mean, it kind of happened early for you, but it seems like, and I've seen it in a bunch of literature too, as well. It's like kind of that 5 to 10 year mark of sobriety is often when this shit comes up to the surface. I think a couple things. I think one, like your experience of doing your inventories, like you were in a situation where you were really lucky because of the sponsor that you had. I think that for some people, it can be very dangerous or re-traumatizing to do those, especially to like, you know, I think a lot of it too, and maybe you just had a different experience, but when it comes to the childhood stuff, I think that a lot of the messaging is just get over it.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yep. Yeah. And that, so that whole thing about it being, you know, some people say AA is counterphobic. Yeah. You know, and the thing is, what is good advice for somebody early on, no matter what you're feeling, mm-hmm. go to a meeting and don't drink. Mm-hmm, but exactly. The idea of, you know, no, I just shot somebody, but it's okay. I didn't drink today. No, I'm glad you didn't drink, but you got to deal with the fact you shot somebody.
Yeah. And then the other thing too is, you know, I think generally speaking, most people, they need to get the sobriety under control before they do this deeper work. But yes. I think that there are other people who are unable to accumulate any time because they have to deal with it right away. And I'm curious what your professional experience has been in that.
Yeah. So those people, I think it's really important that a space be made for them. You know, I don't know how to do it, but they need a lot of gentle reassurance. And, you know, specialized care, you know, my heart goes out to them. Mm-hmm. And I've seen, it's funny as you're saying that, I'm seeing a few people over the years where too much came up too soon. And, you know, and I think in here is, I don't know the numbers, but I think this is probably a significant amount of suicidality here.
I agree too. Especially the people that are like 20 years sober and kill themselves.
Yeah.
The people that have long-term sobriety that are fucking miserable still are people who desperately need ACA.
Yeah. It's like somebody got really, one of the old-time AA people said, I was speaking at a convention. I just said, I thank AA for my sobriety and Al-Anon for my serenity. Mm. But that's how I felt that day. That's how I feel a lot.
Another quote that you have in Susan's book that I think is so good is she goes, you say, to find yourself alone, not by choice, is the only gateway you'll ever have to really knowing yourself. What do you mean by that?
When we're rejected, there's a shattering. Susan talks about her work. There's a shattering of our defenses, and you're there by yourself. And it's, I think we spend our whole lives not to feel that. But only in there. It doesn't have to be a massive shattering, but that type of shattering, it could be the loss of a job, and that's my identity and things like that. But when somebody's lost their identity and lost a sense of who they are, and it's not like I retired, I was, you know, so whatever that is, and when that comes up, and everybody has different defenses, but when those defenses are lowered enough to realize, oh shit, I'm in here by myself.
Yeah. Mm.
That, yeah.
My last question for you is, and I mentioned this in the beginning about how it's so difficult to find good help as it relates to these issues. What are your tips as far as questions that people should be asking to potential therapists to see if they're a good fit for treating this abandonment trauma?
Yeah, I think that asking about their sense of complex trauma as it relates to abandonment. And so the client should be interviewing the therapist and putting the therapist on the hot seat, you know. And if you ever want to see a bunch of defensive people, get a group of therapists together. So the thing is, but no, you know, if you say to a therapist, what about abandonment trauma, that if a therapist might not get it, you know, I hope they did, but like, how do you deal with long-term complex PTSD, you know, and distinguishing that from single incident trauma, you know, which is, I think they should actually call different things because they're so, but the long a long-term pattern of feelings of rejection. How would you do that? And to ask the, and to, you know, and then, yeah, I think that's it, to ask, you know, and then ask the potential client, do you feel comfortable with this person? Because if it's a codependent, they'll try to please the therapist and things like that. And if they say you're depressed, say to the therapist, could it be complex trauma? I'm involved with a case now, which, you know, every outward sign looked like depression and I didn't buy it, you know? And I mean, I didn't fight it, but you know, my internal diagnosis with this client was, let's keep working and things like that. And it went to psychiatrist, got some antidepressant medicine, some, you know, maybe some medicine to help sleep, which probably was good. But the client knew relatively soon that the antidepressant wasn't, he said, I don't want it. I said, well, get permission to get off it and things like that. And then by introducing the trauma and looking at some of the physical, the body stuff, you know, there was some symptoms and you know, 2 years later, it's clearly a case of complex PTSD. And we're not at the bottom of it, you know. So, you know, to basically suggest, you know, ask if you do, I would suggest to the client, how do you work with complex trauma? How do you work with long-term trauma? Do you have any familiarity with the ACA program and that literature? Yeah.
Well, you are a remarkable human. What a life you've lived.
Thank you.
How does it feel? I mean, are you able to, this is like, like to say to people like you and to Susan and Tian, like, are you able to soak in and really feel the lives in which you've saved? Are you able to appreciate that?
More and more. Okay. More. And because what's happened is, interestingly, a bunch of people that I've worked with over the years have cycled back and things like that. You know, one of my present clients is a personal trainer in the town where the school was that I worked.
Wow.
And so he's run into several people. And he says, and you know, he says, and his, I didn't know his father, but his father and relatives went to that school. He says, oh, you know, Pete Young, oh yeah. And so, and the names come back and he says, do you remember so-and-so? And I just, and yeah. So you realize over a period of time and it keeps coming in more. And so Susan has pushed me, and that was the thing at the wedding. She was with some other people that are, the fellow from Princeton, some other people like that. And they said, he's got to write this book. So I started writing it, and Susan, I had some of it. So everything in the universe is telling me, this is my next step. I should be doing this. Now, a kid with a writing disability is supposed to be writing a book. Sounds crazy. That's one of the reasons we're talking today, that I, you know, because I'm not looking to be famous or anything like that. But on the other hand, it's like a Buddhist. Don't approach, don't avoid. So I'm trying not to avoid. But I feel that
a memoir? The writing of the story?
Yeah, I guess it's got a memoir, but maybe interspersed with. It's actually in Tian Dayton's book. I can't think of the name of it, the psychodrama book. Mm-hmm. And she referenced my book. This is 20 years ago, Infinite Hope. I haven't changed the title. So but she referenced that upcoming book, this. Obviously, I'm a slow learner or a late bloomer.
That's so funny. I'll have to tell if I talk to him. Well, thank you so much for your time. I'm going to include everything in the show notes. And then, are you accepting patients? New clients?
No, I'm not. And it's hard for me. I have to work my code. I have to say no, I'm not. Don't let it all go. What you-